WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Yes, welcome to another Monday Night Talk, the final Monday night of November, November 2017. Where the heck is the time gone? I don't know. Joining me, he's here just a bit early, but he's here for his 6:20 segment. None other than State Representative Matt Muratori, representing the First Plymouth.
First Plymouth, yes.
I got these down. Mm. At least some of them. Anyways, he's here. He's going to be joining me. Little story to it, and that is we're going to have State Rep Jim Campbell come for an extended discussion last week. He was cut short by the rock and roll governor, Charlie Baker, who actually was talking. We talked about a couple of different things. Podcast is up if you haven't had a chance to hear the governor. We talked about a couple of different things. In regards to ongoing efforts to do things with the opioid and heroin epidemic. We just discussed that, I guess, a package that had been put forth, the CARES Act. I'm correct.
Pilots. Correct. Yeah.
Follow up to STEP Act, or it's a follow up to a previous legislation that the governor had put forth
back in March of 2015.
That is correct. So he was on about that, and so Jim's time was shortened. And so what I said to Representative Cantwell was that I would give him an extended conversation. We got in a real good conversation about his trip to Bonn, Germany. He and the other member of the law firm, Representative Cutler, who went over there for climate control talks, the UN climate control talks. And so I said, you can come here and we'll talk a little bit about the criminal justice reform bill, which I believe there's two versions that had been passed, one by the House, one by the Senate.
Right.
And so I said to him, but, you know, tell me who you want to have come want in. Do you want to have maybe a... another representative, and he mentioned you. He goes, oh, yeah, we can have like a bipartisan type of thing we can do. And if not him, maybe I'll ask, my Bonn, Germany friend and law firm partner, Rep. Cutler, to come in. And ended up that the representative could not come in. He's actually, something had come up in regards to some work, something that he's doing with his son. Time's kind of short. And so I said, hey, no problem. Oddly enough, though, as I saw Representative Muratori's, he's very good at social media, and he put something out, tweet loops, looking forward to coming on.
6:30 this morning it went out.
6:30 this morning. He did not hesitate. So me, I was like...
But then I said, I probably should check with Kevin first.
Well, the thing was, is that, your name did come up. So when I saw the tweet, I said, oh, all right, well, Jim, Representative Cantwell reached out to Matt. And so everything's all good, because I had sent Representative Cantwell a text yesterday going, hey, what's going on? So my first impression was that's what had happened. But more that I've had dialogue back and forth with Representative Cantwell, he will not be attending, but I have given him kind of a hall pass until the next time we need to have a conversation. And he's usually good. All the representatives on the South Shore, whether it's the House or Senate, have been really good as to coming in on the program. Whenever there's breaking news, doing something for the news department. So it's definitely appreciated. At least we have communication with the folks in both sides of the legislative, the legislative part of our government, which is fantastic. Now, besides Mr. Muratori, who's going to be here to talk a little bit about Thanksgiving, the Thanksgiving parade, America's hometown. He'll have a chance to talk about anything he wants. If he wants to talk about the criminal, criminal justice reform bill, we can. There are other things we can talk about with the time that you're allotted. Then we have a state representative candidate, Kristen Arute. Remember her? Kristen running 2 years ago. Well, actually, a year ago. And she faced off against the current Third Plymouth state rep, Joan Moschino. And so Kristen is throwing her hat in the ring again. So Kristen will be here to chat a little bit about her campaign. We also have from the South Shore Vocational Technical High School Superintendent Director, Dr. Tom Hickey, and the school committee chairman himself, Bob Mola. Talk a little bit about the regional agreement that they've been working on. There is a discussion. I think there are 8 communities that are part of the South Shore Voc region, or those are the communities that are part of the VOTEC, and they're talking about adding another one. I think Hull is in the conversation. And we'll give you more details in just a moment.
Brennan's Smoke Shop is proud to raise money for local veterans organizations year-round. It is because of veterans we have the liberty of speaking to you freely via radio broadcasting. It's a right we at Brennan's hold close. We hold it so close to the heart of our business, freedom of speech. Without it, you might never hear my voice. Or any other. So to all the veterans, active military servant at home and abroad, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Brennan's Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, and now on Pope's Island, New Bedford. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the very best smoke shop in Massachusetts. Customers must have a valid state or federal ID to enter the store. Visit brennanssmokeshopma.com.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
I'm going to tell you, I'm a fan of Van Halen. Nice little Van Halen bit coming back in. Just to complete the circle for you, as we mentioned, Matt Muratori here. We'll get chatting with him in just a half a second. Kristen Arute, Dr. Tom Hickey, and Bob Moeller from the Social Vocational Technical High School. Of course, Bob is with the school committee. He's the chair. And then Erin Maher Alves. She's the author of the book, The Crazy Bee. And we'll chat with her about that. It's her first book. And it's kind of what I've been doing the past couple of months is usually the final segment is kind of like an author or something. It's what I've been doing, Representative.
That's great.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I had a chance to watch you over the weekend.
Folks, I'm sorry.
Watch him do work. No, I thought you did a fantastic job.
Thank you.
And the fine folks down at PAC TV. And folks don't know what I'm talking about. That is the annual production, the work that goes into the America's Hometown Thanksgiving Parade. And it's fantastic that I can sit home and watch it, watch yourself, Donna Rodriguez, who is with PAC TV. Who was the other gentleman that was sitting
with you? Dr. Reverend Paul Jaley.
Dr. Reverend Paul. And he was dressed the part.
He always is.
Dressed the part. But it was fantastic. The work that they do, all the cameras, opening up with the Gina Mark band as they were performing, that was pretty unique. And then watching as like the different bands and the different groups and the cars and the celebrities and the folks who are part of it. And I think you have Vinny DiMacedo who's there somewhere. Ollie probably is around there somewhere too.
Ollie runs the whole thing.
Both of them, the DiMacedo boys, doing a great job. And again, the folks down at PAC TV to be able to put this all together and broadcast it. It's fantastic.
It really is. I appreciate you bringing that up and thank you for your compliments. It's a great production what they do. It's great quality of what they do for this parade. As you know, the parade was a Saturday before Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. So we were doing this live as it was going on. We were watching a monitor, and everything was coordinated back from the trucks to the waterfront back to us in the studio. We had, you know, earpieces in so we could hear what was happening as well. So it was they make it very smooth to actually call the parade. It's not as easy as it looks, though. I mean, you do this all the time and you make it look easy. It is easy for you, but for somebody like me that's not used to it, it's not that easy to do. But with the crew that they have there, the volunteers and the staff, they had over 20 people involved with it. They make it very easy to help tell the story of what's happening. And this parade is the 20th anniversary of this parade. And it goes in chronological years. Mm. So it starts with 1620 and works up to the current day. So it's told in four different parts. And it's the only one of its kind. They estimate over 150,000 people came to this parade.
I believe
it was more than last year. And I think there was actually more. You could tell by looking at the hill, you know, how many people are really in town for this. And it's only going to get better and bigger as we approach 2020.
Yeah, people talk about the Macy's Day Parade. I'm more enthralled with, you know, the local parade, the production that goes in at the different camera angles. They get like a nice jib that kind of flies over, you know, the parade, so to speak. So you can be able to kind of get that nice shot as the... You know, whether it's an organization, whether it's a community group or a band from, you know, out of state.
Yeah.
They do a couple of bands from out of state.
There was
and they're
few.
Performing.
Yeah. Like,
and seeing how well coordinated they were as when they're marching. And
a number of bands come from out of state for this. Drum and Bugle, of course, from out of state come to this. This is ranked every year as one of the top 10 parades in the whole country. AOL a couple of years ago had it as number one. Number two behind Macy's. So it just gets better and better every year. Ollie DeMacedo is incredible with his team of volunteers, and they're all volunteers to do this. And they have to raise $125,000 to $150,000 on their own to do this every year, and they do it. And they have different floats every year. The floats, the meticulous work that they put in the floats is unbelievable. It's great quality.
It is great quality. The production is great quality. And it also is, if I had to put it in, if I was to give a comparison, I'm also a fan of watching when you guys do the telethon, the annual telethon in March. And that's so well coordinated. Yes, yeah. And the different folks, I think you probably from time to time have done boards where you got to sell off boards and try to get them up. Our own Rob Hackler has been down there and trying to get it up.
Rob and I did it together last year.
I think I heard Tom O'Brien.
Yes,
Vinny is down County Treasurer.
Yeah.
Do it. And a whole host of folks who go down there and do it. And that's a well-coordinated production as well. So it's
definitely. And it's all PAC TV, which is behind the scenes of all this. And they just do a fantastic job.
Plymouth Area Community Television.
Yeah, absolutely. It's where it's at.
Got to give them some love. Get a chance to check out the website. Yeah.
And also by at the parade, too. Channel 5 was there. Channel 5 is, I think it's been 11 years.
The morning show.
The morning show has been there.
Yep.
And
Randy
this year,
Price.
This year, 10NBC was there as well. And they're looking at this for the 2020.
Really?
So some things may come of that.
How is it the ATD doesn't have a float in?
Well, you can. You can do one. You see the quality of it.
Larry's looking at me. He's like, what?
Maybe you could do a bobble of Ed Perry. He's not here still, is he? Did he leave?
He's somewhere in the building still. We'll have to ask him about that. Well, seeing we celebrated our 40th, it would have been
a fantastic time to
have a float with all the folks who produce award-winning programs.
There was a radio station down in Cape Cod that really advertises a lot of this, and they were actually in the parade, too. I think they had one of the old cars. And they drove that in there.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, we have you here to kind of talk about some legislation, stuff that you're doing in the district as well. Promote anything that you got going on. And one of the things, as I mentioned at the top of the show, was I was going to talk with Jim in regards to Rep. Jim Cantwell about the criminal justice reform legislation that was put forth. Interesting vote, 144-9. That was the information that I had.
Correct.
Give me your impression on this, because there are 9 folks who did not vote for this, and I'm sure that they had a reason. How do you feel about this bill?
You know, there was a lot of good in this, and there's some things that probably, you know, weren't so good. But if you take it as a whole, which is what I did, I voted for it because of the whole. I think it makes some improvements to the criminal justice system. I actually met with D.A. Cruz and Sheriff McDonald and some other law enforcement people ahead of time to see what's the good, bad, and the ugly in it. And I think the House bill, and I think most people may agree with this, except the folks on the Senate side, but the House bill probably has a lot more... improvements that were needed in the criminal justice system that make more sense than maybe on the Senate side. We passed this 2 weeks ago. It'll be 2 weeks ago tomorrow, that this was passed on the House side. It was two full days of debate, days and nights of debates that we did this. And so I think we came up with a pretty good bill. I think the nine people who voted against it, it wasn't all Republicans. It was some Republicans and Democrats as well. And they all had their individual reasons why. But there may have been certain things that they were looking for in the bill that that didn't come through, so that's why they voted against it.
How about, you know, the big thing that I mentioned earlier in regards to having the governor on and talking about his work for new legislation, a new package to, you know, the next tier in fighting the opioid epidemic, and you know, when we think that we're starting to make headway with beds and treatment and solutions, we have things like fentanyl, carfentanyl, come out of nowhere. Anything in this bill that will deal with folks who are bringing stuff like that into our communities?
Yeah, there is some more penalties associated with folks that are peddling the fentanyl. As you know, it actually strengthens the penalties for crimes. There's 81% of the overdoses now contain some sort of fentanyl in them. One of the things that we were trying to push in the House, this House bill, was that to put the charges with manslaughter or murder if there's anybody that dies of an overdose because there's fentanyl in it, and we find out who the dealer actually is that sold it. That has not gone through yet. It didn't go through in this bill, but there was a lot of talk about it, and to the point that the Speaker of the House came out over the weekend to say that there will be some studies being done on this to see if it does make sense to charge with, you know, first degree or second degree of manslaughter, if we can connect the dealer to the death of the individual that overdoses. I think there's some more to come on this. There's a lot of similarities in the House and the Senate bill, but there's also a lot of differences as well. One of the biggest differences had to do with raising the age of criminal responsibility from 18 to 19. That was in the Senate version, was not in the House version. Legalizing sex between teenagers, close in age, was in the Senate version, but not in the House version. So there is, and it goes on and on. There are a lot of differences between both bills. The conference committee, as you know, usually a conference committee is appointed soon after the bills have been.
Handful of folks who get together.
Yeah, there's usually three and three. Three senators and three House people. As of today, the conference committee has not even been put together yet.
Really?
Now, I'm not sure if that's a function of we are on recess until the first of the year or what it is. But there's going to be a lot of work have to be done in this conference committee to try to come to some resolutions on a lot of these issues that the Senate feels strongly about and the House feels strongly about.
There was also some language in regards to eliminating certain mandatory minimums. What were those?
Yeah, there was a lot in so many different areas that was eliminated. The feeling was that the parole boards and judges really should have more discretion on these, they should be able to decide, you know, what's the minimum, what's the mandatory on these, and sometimes I think the feeling is that there are things that may be so minor, but the judges are stuck to live within what the regulations are with the minimum.
So you're saying it creates like a flexibility?
Exactly. Exactly right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And then there was another one here. Expungement of records for young adults who are between the ages of 18 and 21. What's the importance of that?
Well, I think it's trying to not hurt somebody's life. We know as teenagers, especially teenage boys, we do stupid things sometimes. And you don't want to hurt them going into careers and colleges and all that. So I think it's trying to give people the benefit of the doubt, particularly for first-time offenses of things that happen. So I think that's some of the thinking that went behind it.
Okay. Overall, I would take it that you were pleased with this legislation and you're, I'm sure, awaiting to see what the conference committee does?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's, things needed to change. It probably wasn't the best because there were so many things that you could see in this. Like I said, there was a lot of good things that are in this. So for me, it outweighed not voting for it. It made sense to vote for it because there's a lot of good things in it.
Get any kind of sense of how the governor feels about this legislation? And is this something, depending on how it comes out of committee, if he's going to be willing to put his signature on it.
I think that's going to be the big question mark. We actually met with the governor, I think it was the same day, actually. And the Senate version was probably not as favorable to most people as the House version. What we saw as unraveling probably would make more sense, but we have to wait to see what the conference committee comes up with.
I know you also want to mention something about a veterans bill.
Yeah, there's a couple other things we did during the last day of session. One was a veterans bill, which you know how we get our property taxes or excise taxes, and sometimes you can check off a box.
Right.
So this. Cities and towns will have the option now to check off a box on your excise tax or your property tax to donate to a veterans fund in your community. You know, we are number one in the state. In the country. Massachusetts is number one in the country dealing with veterans and veterans benefits, but we can always do better, and this does a little bit more for that. It allows for that to actually give some more money to the veterans organizations. So I thought that was a good bill that actually passed. And we also did a designated parking space. So cities and towns will have the option to designate a veterans parking space at no cost, any veteran that goes into a city hall or a town hall in their community. These are little things.
Any parameters as to the parking spot? Is it like a semi-handicap?
Just a veterans parking space.
If you're a veteran, it's
that's
yours.
Right. Okay. And it'll say veterans parking space. That'll be somewhere close, you know, close to the
Is building. That new? Is it, or is it being something that's being done elsewhere in regards to a parking spot?
It's new here, obviously, to this state. I thought I heard there may have been one or two states that have looked at that, but I'm not sure anybody has actually done it yet.
Okay.
Just another way to honor veterans for what they've done for our country.
What else do we got going on?
Well, what else have we got going on? Well, I can never not talk about the 400. You know that, Kevin.
Yeah.
You know, and I tell you, with the parade that just went on, we had the chairperson of the State Commission for the Plymouth 400, Dusty Rhodes, who, as you know, Dusty has put on many major events over the last 40 years, the tall ships being the major thing that she does. And she was so impressed with the community spirit, not just Plymouth, but the whole South Shore. And you can start feeling the energy, what's going to be happening for 2020. There's some big things that are going to be happening. They had an illumination program that same night of the parade as well. And the church that it was at was standing room only, and people were outside for this illumination. So you can see the excitement happening. A number of millions of dollars and resources have been given to the town of Plymouth. And more to come. We're also looking at the federal delegation to help us with some federal funds as well. But there's going to be major contributions coming from the private sector as well. So that's starting to happen now.
How about the lobsters? How are they doing?
The lobsters are doing fine.
Have we had a check on the lobsters?
There is no...
Make sure none have gone missing.
There is no issues with the lobsters. They're all in place. I
Ed
think.
The lobster's back, right?
Ed the lobster was back. I think everyone learned their lesson on that. I think it was, you know, that the gentleman, you know, you talk about young kids making stupid mistakes, did community service and did it, you know, with a smile on his face and all apologetic. And I don't think you'll see that happen again. A couple other things that just real quickly, I just wanted to mention that we've had some discussions about commuter rail on the South Shore. And particularly to do with the Plymouth-Kingston area. As you know, Plymouth still has a line that comes by Cordage Park. So we met with the MBTA folks a couple of weeks ago to kind of talk about that, how that Cordage is breaking ground on the 272 units apartments there with more to come. We want to start having the conversation of how we can make that more user-friendly, the Plymouth and Kingston, whether it's going to be Plymouth-Kingston temporarily, and they go to Kingston, but we have to get them down to downtown Plymouth to get them to the waterfront, the other attractions in town. So there's going to be some more coming out of the commuter rail, too, for the Plymouth-Kingston area. And also the other thing we've been talking about is dredging. We coordinated a meeting with the county, Plymouth County, and Secretary Ash. And his staff, because we know the county has a dredging machine.
Mm-hmm.
So and the Secretary Ash has a number of areas that need to be dredged in the harbor. So we've got them together to try to figure out how can we actually do that and help all along the coast, particularly the South Shore coast. But he also suggested talking to the North Shore as well. So we're trying to coordinate that and trying to get some hopefully some movement on dredging.
Yeah, I wonder how my buddy, my friends on the county commissioners are feeling about this. I know this was Sandra Wright, I think, was the one of the leading ones.
Yep, that's right.
But I know Danny Pallotta has touted it a few times as well.
Mm-hmm.
As well as Greg Hanley.
Yeah.
We'll throw some names around here.
Yeah, no, they're all for it, trying to see what they can do to help out with the state, but also try to get some resources for this unique machine that they have.
Folks want to get in touch with you? They got a question in regards to district hours or anything?
How can feel free to give my office a call, 617-722-2014. The year I was elected, 2014. That's how I remember it.
Big plans for Christmas or the holidays? Have you started shopping yet?
No, it's not the 24th of December yet.
Good man. Same here. You didn't find me in any of those lines.
I
can't bring myself to it yet.
No, not yet. No, we have a large family, so we do Christmas at home. We're too big to go anywhere else, and we have people over just like we do Thanksgiving, and so we always look forward to the holidays.
Well, we thank you very much for
my pleasure.
Pinch hitting for Representative Cantwell. He, of course, probably owes you a fruit basket or something for stepping up.
He owes me a lot.
maybe you could be a membership into the law firm.
No, thanks.
Okay. Anyways.
Thanks for having me.
Representative, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We are going to step aside. And on deck, Kristen Arut, running for state rep. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Monday Night Talk.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, we return to Monday Night Talk. And joining us, old friend, seems like an old friend, somebody who's been on this program prior, during your campaign, was it a year ago?
It was last year, 2016.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
Hard to believe.
And yeah, I'm always keeping my eyes on the internet and social media. And when I saw that you have a campaign kickoff.
Yes.
Just a couple of days?
Tomorrow night.
Okay.
Yep.
Close. When I noticed it was a couple of days, I said, hey. And we've been doing that. We're trying to bring folks in who are getting out of the gate early.
Mm-hmm.
I call it early, but this is usually tentatively the time of year that folks will announce, or they'll do it, you know, maybe January, February, March, depending on how serious their campaign is. You know, some folks, you know, they get started, you know, in January.
Right.
You're like, oh my God, they got a whole full 2 years, but it's been successful. I have seen campaigns where folks have actually run for two years to get the name recognition.
Exactly.
So what have you been up to since we last chatted with you?
Well, before I jump into that, I have a little something for you. I don't know if it's customary to bring gifts, but I brought you one.
Well, it's a new custom now.
I want to set the bar for everyone else.
Oh, boy. Did my next guest bring anything?
I don't know. They look like they're sweating.
That's right. They'll have to have some of the kids over the brass lantern make me something. This is awesome. And this is baseball players?
It's baseball players.
Wow.
Yes, with Patriots ribbon.
Wow.
Pretty cool.
Wow, you really hit a home run. This is fantastic. And what inspired you to bring me such an awesome gift?
I don't know, just because I was happy to be here and
okay.
Looking forward to seeing you and wanted to do something nice and wanted to make you like me.
It is so noted, and it'll be noted in the podcast as well. So talk to us a little bit. What are you running a second time for? Talk to us about running for state rep.
Why am I running again?
Yeah.
I am running again because when I ran in 2016, I had lots of conversations door to door, in person, online, talked to a lot of people, and I felt as though I got a sense of the things that are important, the issues that are important to people in our district. And I was really excited to run. I really enjoyed campaigning. I felt as though my broad experience appealed to a lot of people. Since then, I've been doing a number of other things. I'm now co-chair of Hingham Cares, which is a substance misuse prevention coalition in Hingham.
Right.
So I've been getting up to speed on the marijuana law. And, of course, the opioid crisis has been in the headlines for several years now. I'm on Council on Aging. I've been on Council on Aging in Hingham for a couple of years. I am now a member and provide administrative support to the Truro Part-Time Resident Taxpayers Association, where we have, we own property and rent property down there. So, bunch of new and different things.
When do you sleep? This doesn't sound like you sleep. Sounds like you are very busy and you're touching areas that concern people, I mean, the opioid epidemic is, it's large, and there's no light at the end of the tunnel at this point in time when you have things like fentanyl and carfentanil being introduced on top of opioids and heroin. And
yes. Well, we're on the forefront here in Massachusetts. With Governor Baker's leadership, he's instituted some really tremendous legislation, and other states in the country have modeled their legislation after ours. So we're definitely on the cutting edge. There's certainly more that we can do. I was listening to your conversation with Representative Muratori, and they were talking about the new criminal justice reform bill and the elimination of some of the mandated sentences and minimum sentences.
Concerns?
Definitely concerns. I mean,
please
I
share.
Think, well, one of my top concerns is if we have somebody with who's in possession of a deadly amount of a deadly drug, there's no good reason for that. There should be mandatory sentences for someone like that, because that essentially is poison and can do a tremendous amount of harm, and it should be treated as such. I also have concerns about the industry, the treatment industry. There are definitely some industry standards that we can improve upon as well. So we're at the forefront in a lot of ways, and we can also make improvements in other ways as well.
What are you hearing from the voters since you have announced that I'm running for state rep again? What are you hearing from the voters? How do they feel about your candidacy, and what are they emphasizing to you? Some of the things that you should be focusing on the campaign trail.
Well, certainly the opioid crisis and the marijuana legislation that's just come down is definitely complex and confusing, and has started a lot of conversations. Hingham, the town that I live in, is in the process of drafting articles for our warrant to be voted on at town meeting.
Get April 1st to get a vote out.
Yep, exactly, exactly. So that's certainly at the forefront of people's minds. I think taxes and fiscal responsibility is always a common denominator. Regardless of where you stand on the political spectrum, people are concerned about how their money is being spent. I was one of the first co-signers of a petition to end open road tolling, because there's a bill on Beacon Hill to expand open road tolling using transporters to even including our waterways. Currently the bill includes, I believe it's Route 1, Route 2, 95, and 128. I think I'm getting those correct. In addition to waterways from Cape Ann to Plymouth, incorporating those into our open road system. So I think people have concerns about, number one, you know, more money being taken out of their pockets, and number two, where is that information going? How is that information being collected? Where is it, or where is it being collected, and how is it being disseminated, if it is being disseminated? So lots of red flags with that one.
Well, there was a conversation not too long ago. We had the representative from the 5th Plymouth District, Dave DeCoste, and I would say eight months ago, and we're talking about an interesting concept of putting a toll road on Route 3, right around the Norwell stretch, right up to the bottleneck. And it was an interesting conversation. Folks were calling in, and they weren't too happy about it. And anybody who watched what happened on social media, people were outraged by it.
Yes.
But if you spoke to people on the western part of the Commonwealth, Well, they've been, you know, anytime you go on the Mass Pike, you know, it's not free. It hasn't been.
Right.
And a lot of folks in the western part of the state feel that us on the east side of Massachusetts, the southeastern part, should pay our fair share. So it could be an interesting conversation if you are somebody who is fortunate next September and next November to be a member of the House.
Definitely an interesting conversation, and your point is well taken, that there are some issues that are resonate differently depending on the part of the state that you're in. For example, we deal with coastal issues in our district. People in western and central Mass don't deal with coastal issues. So, as a state representative for the 3rd Plymouth District, I would be representing my district to the best way, to the best of my ability. So that would include preventing open road tolling on Route 3.
What's your sense as to the purpose of open road tolling? Where would that money go? Is it strictly going to be for transportation infrastructure, or is there a deviance as to where that money would go once it's in the general fund?
Well, that's a big question mark, too. I mean, I think the understanding is that it would go to maintaining our roads and our transportation infrastructure, as you put it, but that remains to be seen.
Now, you're looking forward to the possibly another Republican stepping in and being a part of the race, or it's right now.
Am I looking forward to that?
Are you looking forward to having a debate with somebody to be able to get the party's nomination and then take on the incumbent?
I wouldn't say I'm looking forward to that, because right now my eyes are very much focused on November 8th of 2018.
Very good. Okay.
And I'm very much interested in establishing myself as the candidate, getting the word out, enabling people to understand who I am, what my platform is, my experience, that sort of thing. So I'm very much focused on that and November. I haven't given September a thought, to be quite honest with you.
I ask you that because I have had conversations with candidates who look forward to having somebody that will at least keep them honest right up until the primary, and then at least they will be, you know, ready for a general election.
I'm counting on the voters to keep me honest.
Okay. I like that. What other issues are there? I mean, with your district, I mean, is it strictly just taxes? Where does education stand? Where does local aid stand?
Well, there is one, not to deviate from your question, but there is one bill in particular that I've been following. I was actually one of three people who put together a forum last spring on it. It's Senate Bill 81. I call it a regionalized zoning bill. Okay. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it.
No, please share.
It's a bill that would take the housing issue to the next level. So essentially what it does, it would establish a regionalized zoning board that would be responsible for overseeing the implementation of the specific mandates in this bill. So an added layer of government. And it would remove the local control of zoning from local communities. So it would allow developers and builders to come in and completely bypass the permitting process within communities. For example, it would allow dense multifamily housing by right. It would allow accessory dwelling units by right. And it also, the tricky thing is that it opens communities up to the potential for for litigation. If a family comes in and they are looking for housing in a particular town, and they decide that there isn't adequate housing, workforce housing, the
Chapter
and they
40.
Met the standards. No, this 40B. Is actually different. 40B is affordable housing. This would be workforce housing.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so it's a different set of standards.
Where would this regional board, would they have anything to do with Chapter 40, or would that be separate to itself?
I believe it would still be separate unto itself.
Okay.
Yes, so this is new legislation. So Hingham, for example, has already reached its safe harbor status with regard to 40B. We've achieved our 10% housing inventory. I know a lot of communities haven't, but this just adds another layer to that. Exactly. I think it's well-intentioned in some regard. Everybody wants people to be able to own a home, live in a home, live in a community that that they want to. But in terms of the impact on communities, this is a very far-reaching bill.
Okay. And what kind of support is this bill getting so far?
I know that it's in committee. I know that there have been several hearings on it. Certainly, the construction industry is in favor of it. I'm not sure exactly where it stands. I think it's going to be taken up again in January.
Okay, so something definitely to keep an eye on.
Something to keep an eye on, absolutely. It's not anything impending per se, but certainly within the next year or two, we'll see some progress on this bill.
Noelle, we just have a couple more minutes left here. Anything that I haven't asked you during this brief visit to Monday Night Talk that you want to at least touch upon or at least remind folks about a website, social media, or your big kickoff tomorrow night?
Sure. People can reach me at kristenarute.com. It's kristenarute.com. My email address is kristenarute@gmail.com. I have a Facebook page, Kristen Arute for State Representative. So please come and check it out and see what I have going on. I'll be updating my Facebook page and updating my website as I move forward. I'm excited to be hitting the ground and getting to know people, knocking on doors. And last time I only had 100 days. I'm sure you remember that crazy, frenzied campaign.
But you did well.
I did do well.
You
I got 46% of the vote. Yes.
Nothing to sneeze
days.
At.
Nothing to sneeze at. So now I have a full year.
Now you have a full year.
Yes.
What will Kristen Arute do?
What can I do in 365 days?
Wow. Out of control. I want to thank you for coming in. I want to thank you for the tremendous gift. Did you have a good holiday?
I had a very nice holiday. Yes.
What'd you do?
Thank
Share.
You. My sister lives, speaking of Central Mass, my sister lives in Central Mass, so we were there for the holiday. My parents just sold their house in Norwell, and they're moving their building in Hull, but in the process, they're kind of all over the place. So we no longer celebrate family holidays in my childhood home, which is kind of a strange thing to get accustomed to, but I'll be hosting Christmas this year, which will be nice.
Yay.
So, yeah.
Okay. Now, what about the holidays? Now, ready for Christmas? Are you one of those people who you already did all your shopping last week, or you've been doing it since October?
I am a planner. I am a major planner.
Really?
Yes, it's kind of crazy. But the nice thing about planning is you get to take advantage of sales. So what I do is I buy winter-related items in January, February, after the holidays, and then I just save them for Christmas.
My grandmother would like you. My grandmother was very much like that. She, you know, and it'd be one of those things where, Grandma, what are you going out shopping for Christmas stuff, you know, in late December, early January? But she was smart.
Yes. Yeah.
She knew.
You can find some good deals. This year is the first year we've actually pulled names. So my kids are in their 20s. My niece and nephew are in their 20s. My nephew's wife. So we don't have like fun toy gifts to give anymore. But of course, we all want to give to the kids. We call them the kids. But the adults have all drawn names for each other. So this is the first year that I'm not buying for every member of my family. We're focusing on one person each, which is kind of a new
concept.
You're
not doing the Yankee swap thing.
Not doing Yankee swap. No.
See, I did the Yankee. I got multiple siblings, and there's always that one sibling who wants to pull the wool over everybody's eyes and find a slick way. One of my younger sisters has found a way 2 years in a row, because the whole idea is if you draw first, you get to pick last.
That's right. How
we do it.
Yes.
And 2 years in a row, and she's just very clever. She pulls the first one, and we're like, you can't do that 2 years in a row. She usually gets, and she'll walk out, and as soon as she gets the best gift, she's gone.
Well, now you know to stay on top of her.
No, I just don't participate in the Yankee swap. I want to thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We will look forward to keeping an eye on you on the trail.
Excellent.
As we watch all the other campaigns as they're kicking off. We've seen so many of them in 2017 kick off, and yours is one of them. So we'll definitely be following your race.
Fantastic.
All right.
Thank you so much.
We are going to step aside when we come back. Hour number two of Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.
It happened at the supermarket, November 20th, 1993, a Saturday. Most people do not buy duck. We are not a duck-eating people. Who thinks of duck? College quarterback Dick Wright did. On impulse, he pulled a nice frozen duck out of the freezer. But then he noticed it had the shape and the feel of a football. Cold as Green Bay, but a football. So on his way out, there's his brother by the pickup, about 35 yards. Bill gets a grip on that duck. He faints toward the end zone. His brother goes wide left, and that frozen duck had the ride of its life. That wobbling duck just flew. It smashed through the fingertips of the wide receiver and demolished the windshield of Sal Roseo's 89 Firebird. You just can't put a good spiral on a frozen duck.
I'm Tiny of Tiny & Sons Glass. We come to your work or home, and we fix your windshield. Your insurance company covers it. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call.
My dad did a great job.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right, we're back for hour number two. Don't forget to listen at 7:30 for Erin Maha Alves, author of The Crazy Bee. It's her first book. Looking forward to the interview, but I'm also looking forward to the interview with these two gentlemen who are sitting before me. It has been some time in the works. I remember not too long ago, the South Shore Voc School Committee Chair, Bob Mola, saying, you know, one of these times, like me as a superintendent director, we'd like to come on and talk a little bit about the VOTEC and some of the stuff that we're doing. I forgot what we might have been talking about doing something other than what we're going to discuss tonight, but the idea was just to have a conversation. You serve, and you can correct me, Dr. Tom Hickey, if you want, 8 communities?
That's right.
That's correct. And you're pondering, discussing, mulling a 9th.
That's correct.
Okay. So, in the meantime, you have done some conversations. I, of course, attend school committee meetings, and I'm usually in the front row somewhere. And not too long ago, you guys started working on your agreement, the regional agreement. Why is that?
Well, it's time for an update. It really hasn't been updated since its existence back in 1962. When the school opened, but we also had a minor adjustment back when we admitted Whitman and Hanson to it. And presently, the state, the Commonwealth, is looking for all regional school districts, whether they're vocational or not, to update their agreements. And it's a perfect opportune for us. Superintendent was fortunate enough to get a small grant to help us with the funding on it, and that's where we're going.
Mm. Yeah, Kevin, we were fortunate to apply for a competitive grant. Governor Baker's office, Lieutenant Governor Polito, have put out regionalization and efficiency grants, which are obviously are encouraging municipalities and other entities to regionalize. So we put in an application looking for some funds to achieve two goals. One would be, as Bob said, to help us update our regional agreement. So any legal or consulting advice we might need, as it's been decades since the agreement's been updated. But also some funds were set aside so that the town of Hull could take a closer look at feasibility, pros and cons, of potentially joining the South Shore Regional School District. And it's a lengthy and detailed process that we can certainly unpack a little bit. But this offered us an opportunity for most of this calendar year to work with the Mass Association of Regional Schools, to work with the subcommittee of the school committee, and take a look at an agreement that was originated in the 1960s and tweaked a little bit in the 80s when we had Whitman and Hanson join. So the experience has been a good one because our obviously our school, our district as an entity, came into existence because at the time six communities thought, what a great experiment to regionalize vocational technical education, far more cost effective to do it as a region rather than opening up programs in individual schools.
Right.
Fast forward over 50 years and here we are going strong, but we need to make sure that the governing documents are updated. So one example of something that needed to be updated is we've all talked for the last 25 years now, the 25th anniversary of education reform, 1993. Our regional agreement has no mention of education reform. Now, the statute supersedes anything, but that's an example of something where you probably should spell out in your governing documents the, you know, the one of the signature education reform laws in the Commonwealth. So we've taken our time. We've had great contact with the Department of Education to be able to give us feedback, and now we'll begin the process of going to our respective eight communities. We have to get all eight communities to support changes to the agreement, and this will be on the Whitman special town meeting warrant on December 11th, and then presumably the remaining town meetings will fall this spring. Most of our town meetings are in early May. Situate has a town meeting in April, and Abington typically has one in June. So we've got our work cut out for us.
Well, you usually have your track shoes on in the spring. That's, when you're bouncing around to all these different town meetings.
I need a couple of cardboard cutouts, yes, and some track shoes, and yeah, I can be in multiple places.
And
yeah.
Knowing that you're a Hanson resident, and yes, knowing that Hanson and Whitman have them, I don't know if you clone yourself, but you've been able to bounce from one to the other. So this is kind of a blessing in disguise that Whitman yes. is having a special town meeting December 11th, and you can at least be able to put this forth.
I'm grateful that they were able to put that on the warrant. Yes, if they will support it, it would be one less community to focus on with regional agreement discussions in the spring.
I don't know, folks who are listening, now I know because I'm an insider, so to speak, but there's 21 articles on that warrant, and I think yours is going to be probably the easiest one for folks to be able to go, yeah, that's fine. There are bigger fish to fry on that warrant than, you know, an update on a regional agreement.
Well, I would hope anyone that has questions could certainly reach out. We'd be happy to provide the detail. I think in general, as we've presented to our school committee on multiple occasions, most recently this past month, there are no what I would call major changes in the agreement in terms of who gets to control what. The most important part of any regional agreement is making sure the communities understand how their assessments are calculated. We're asking for no major changes in that area. But certainly updating, I'll give you a couple of examples of things we would update. There are a lot of references in our agreement that if something is going to change, it has to be unanimous. So I could understand back in 1960 when things were gelling to form this district, how it was a rather novel experiment. South Shore is the second oldest regional vocational school in the Commonwealth. McCann Tech out in North Adams was chartered in 1959. So there weren't too many other examples of these entities at the time. So in the regional agreement where it says if you want to amend the agreement, it has to be unanimous. If a town wanted to withdraw, it would have to be unanimous. That means all of the towns would have to agree. So one of the things that we're looking to adjust is if we want to make changes to the agreement in the future, if we wanted a new community to join, or if a community wanted to withdraw, that we're looking to change the threshold to two-thirds. Two-thirds of an affirmative, two-thirds of our town meeting. So in other words, six out of eight communities would be able to support, or you'd need two-thirds of those communities to support any change to the agreement. I don't consider that to be a radical change. I think a two-thirds threshold is reasonable for governance. Getting a unanimous vote is rather difficult. But the fact that we haven't had many changes over the decades suggests it's generally a sound document.
Bob, you recently had folks from Hull before the school committee and had a chance to chat with them. What's it like to have another community that's looking to be a part of the success story that is South Shore Vo-Tech?
Well, I was fortunate enough to go through the Whitman-Hanson part of it, so it wasn't brand new to me. But Hull is a little different. They're 26 miles out into the far distance of us, and their financial position is not as good as some of the others. So they're looking at their, whether it's worth them to join or it's whether they should just take their chances and see if they can get a non-resident student into our system. It doesn't guarantee them any seats, but that they're having a little difficulty with their own system down there. But the subcommittee with Tom, we've gone to several meetings with them. The people that have been there are all positive. They're looking forward to, especially the parents, they're looking to give their students that opportunity of a different type education, not necessarily going to Xaverian or Archbishop Williams, but a trade where their students will always have an opportunity for employment. Mm. And that's our thing.
Talk to me about Dr. Tom Hickey. This guy is, you know, I kind of look at it, I'll use it in a municipal sense. He's almost like your town administrator. You guys are the Board of Selectmen. And he's kind of the guy who does a lot of the yeoman work. He's out there. He comes back. He brings you information. And it's also interesting to kind of see, I've attended many open houses and see as like, I want to say 90% of the kids know who he is. Back in the day, I wouldn't know who my superintendent was in school. I didn't pay attention. I was more worried about my studies. But I see a lot of these kids, and they are fond of this guy. And I'm also seeing other folks from other communities who know who Tom is. Give me your thoughts on having a guy like this at the helm and helping you to get through something like this in welcoming a community like Hull.
Well, in my tenure, I don't want to pat him on the back, but he's
not too much. He's got to get his head out the door.
Please.
He's the best superintendent we've had. He's totally involved in the school, and as you mentioned, every student knows Dr. Hickey down the corridor.
They do.
And the school committee, we have a very good school committee. We all work together, and Dr. Hickey works very much with us. He's in constant communication with us, so when we come to our monthly meeting, every school committee member knows what's going to come off, so we don't get into long debates or against or for, because we've come to the conclusion that Dr. Hickey is right, or we're right, and he's gone to our side, and it's that way. And we have the, I call it the motto of the school committee, if it's not for the students, don't bring it before the committee.
Mm.
And Dr. Hickey has been that way. If it's not for the students, it doesn't come before the committee. And all eight members, up until recently, we just lost one from Cohasset to a death. But we've been the same way. We're all for the students, and we support Dr. Hickey and his administration. He has a fantastic backup crew. They're always helping us. And as you know, we even have awards for the Administrator of the Year now from the school committee. We have the students have an award for the staff member of the month. Mm-hmm. And this, that's the student council does that. And the staff has the student of the month. So we're recognizing everybody for their
work and diligence.
The work, the diligence, and the education of the students and those that are receiving the education.
What's it like for you to be receiving a ringing endorsement from not only the chair, but knowing that you at least, I've seen many, many times whether it you name the board or committee where you could tell a well-oiled machine, you could tell, I mean, it's not a matter of rubber stamping something, but it's a matter of that there's checks and balances, questions asked, and there's a trust that is gained there. It sounds to me like you've got a trust that's gained there.
I agree. I mean, first of all, I don't do praise very well, and I don't call myself Dr. Hickey. But it's very kind to elevate the title for the purpose of this conversation. But the truth is, Kevin, I'm a teacher at heart, and I think any superintendent in this region, if they had the luxury of having my job where their office was inside of a school, they're all educators at heart. And many superintendents are in central offices. They're just by the nature of their job, they make extra efforts. I follow a lot of superintendents on Twitter. I know how they're constantly in buildings. They're constantly in classrooms. I have the luxury of stepping outside my door and being
the boom
there.
Right there.
And as you know, being a parent of I have two sons, and you know, living in the district, it's this school is important to me on multiple levels as a parent, a taxpayer, you know, as an educator. I could not ask for a better governing board, and that trust factor does contribute to efficient meetings, clear communication, no surprises, and you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So as we go into the month of December, we will begin our budget building process. I'll make a presentation. In January, we have public hearings for the budget, and as you talked about, get the track shoes out as we get into the winter. That's where we'll be going to our finance committees and advisory committees, and because we have to build a strong case. Bob always talks about, as a district, we don't put things on the charge card. We don't borrow money very often. Mm. We do need more space. We do need to renovate a 1962 building. Our communities have been supporting our capital expenditures. We've got an engineering firm right now that's helping us with a master facilities plan. We've submitted statements of interest to the MSBA. But in order for anything to move forward beyond an annual appropriation, we've got to make absolutely sure that our communities understand what we're all about, the mission we're trying to achieve, and that we know how to sharpen our pencil when we have to, and also if we have a clear vision and we can show a way to that vision, our communities have been very, very supportive. I'm grateful for all of that.
What are the challenges going forth? And I'll ask you this, Bob, and Tom, you can answer and ring in. What are the challenges? And are there any challenges remaining with this agreement other than town meeting, or is there still more hurdles to overcome?
Well, I think we've overcome most of them, Tom, because the school committee members are actually representatives of the community.
Right.
So
liaisons.
Liaison. So those school committee members, everybody's had part of it. The subcommittee worked the hardest on it, and we presented it to the committee. And as you're aware, they approved it last meeting. Mm-hmm. So it's now gone to the communities. And in the past, the communities have supported us. And Tom and I have gone through to most of the communities, and just to check with the school committee members of those communities to see if we missed anything. And the towns did bring up a couple things, but nothing major. And we've brought it up to date and thought of the communities and their questions. And a lot of them, we had to relate it. State law prevails, and that's what it amounts to. And that's, I can't say enough about our communities either. We have a lot of tenure on the school committee. The communities have supported their members, and it's been well worth it, because my quote is, we have the best vocational school in the Commonwealth. Maybe the best school in the Commonwealth.
There's no bias there, right?
No bias, no, none bias at all.
Yeah, it's about relationships, Kevin. It really is. We are not necessarily front and center in any one community's daily operation. We don't necessarily occupy the biggest part of any town meeting warrant or budget, but we want to make absolutely sure that folks are aware of how we're operating. So we did hold an informational session this summer. We had some representatives at that meeting from our respective towns. We also went and visited other communities so that we can talk face-to-face. Plenty of technology, very easy to send email after email with attachments, and you know, there's more information. It's like drinking out of a fire hose, right? We miss more things than we actually read or digest. A face-to-face conversation can do a lot. And I think that's where the position we're in now is, I feel that the communities are informed, they have opportunities to give feedback, and this will be our next step to move ahead, and I'm looking forward to that. In addition, of course, there's the annual budget conversation, so we know how busy our communities are, the finance committees, advisory committees, all these meetings that happen leading up to a spring town meeting, and asking our communities to also digest changes to a regional agreement document. We wanted to be able to spread it out a bit, and that's why we did it a little earlier.
And we'd like to remind those communities that our budget hearings are open, and a lot of communities have liaisons from their finance committee to our school committee, and I would surely appreciate if they'd send their liaison to us, and that helps solve a lot of the problems when we go to the finance or the selectmen of the communities.
That they at least generally, they have a general understanding.
They have a general idea.
You can send somebody who's, who can comprehend what's going on and not have a mixed signal.
Correct. And we have a zero budget guideline. None of our department heads.
Bob, that was my next topic.
I'll let you present.
Bob, you're reading ahead. What are you doing? Again, we're speaking with South Shore Votech's school committee chair, Bob Mola. And, of course, the superintendent director, Tom Hickey, they're here talking about multiple things, talking about the updating of the regional agreement, talking about South Shore Votech, some of the, hopefully having a new member join. Of course, there's a conversation that's going on with that. And I was going to mention, and it's the few times I sat through my share of eye-rolling budget presentations. I'm not saying this because you're here and not because we're friendly, Tom. But yours is the one that I wish that more communities, municipalities would use. And that is not but building off of last year's budget, but you do something that few do, and that is that zero-based budgeting?
Right. It's there are many parts of a budget where there are fixed costs, and so sure. It's not literally down to zero. Our budget is around $13 million. Sure. Okay. So you have salaries and health insurance, certainly. But almost $5 million of our budget is what we would say would fall outside of salaries, right? So what we say, as Bob said earlier, you know, it's about the students, and so we spend a lot of time focused on building department budgets. Now, in a school like ours, we have English, math, science, social studies, physical education, guidance, special education. But we also have 13 additional departments, one for each vocational program.
Yep.
Specific equipment needs, supply needs, and technology needs. The process that we employ starts in October because we have to have a certified budget in January. And we basically ask our cost center supervisors and our department heads to start with a blank piece of paper. What you needed last year may not be what you need this year. And so we use Google Docs. Every department head fills out a Google Doc budget sheet where I can see every 2x4 in carpentry, and I can see every piece of equipment in every program itemized. And the essential message is that I couldn't do what I do without the faculty doing their job. They are focused on the students, they are very hardworking, and they know that in the year that Department X might need a big sum of money for, say, new textbooks, that next year it could be someone else. So they're also working together. Zero-based budgeting simply means you start with planning your needs 1 year at a time.
Right.
It has allowed me to go to the school committee, and while there are overall budget increases, oftentimes you might look at a comparison year to year and see the numbers going up and down. Some people might say, well, why is it going up and down? Because we're budgeting what we actually need. And as you said, Kevin, not merely adding a few percent, because that would suggest a lack of thought.
Right.
And that's not what we want to do, because we're asking for money to do something really powerful with it. We want to make sure it's in the right place. And that is a total team effort. So right now, late November, this is what we're doing, reviewing all those budget sheets. And I'll be bringing a budget proposal to the committee the third Wednesday of December.
You looking forward to that, Bob?
Definitely. one other thing on the budget. The school committee's on top of it. Our financial officer, secretary, treasurer, presents us the expenditures for every month at our meeting.
Do you want to say his name?
Yeah, Jim Coughlin is our secretary treasurer.
He's a very good person.
Jim's a Facebook friend of mine, and if I put this up and I didn't say, oh, what, did you mention Jim? Jim might not take a picture of me next time I'm at a softball event or something.
And his predecessor, Bob Kelly, I was speaking with him today. He keeps checking in.
How is Bob doing?
He's doing very well. He's going in for hip surgery on the 21st of December. And
good luck, Bob.
Bob is a worry board. but
Bob started that process with the district committee of providing monthly treasurer's reports. Sometimes in other places, perhaps they're quarterly, but every 30 days, the committee is able to see an itemized breakdown of where the dollars are going. And we can forecast trends, which is helpful so that as we get closer to the end of the fiscal year, the committee knows what's in good shape and where we might need to make some budget transfers. It's helpful to everybody.
Knowing that you're getting ready to make a presentation, what has it been? What has it been like looking at the numbers? You're looking at, you know, fiscal 2019.
Mm-hmm.
Not without tipping your hand or anything. Mm-hmm. What's it been like so far putting everything together?
It's I enjoy the process. It's really easy when you have a shared vision, and you just have to figure out, do you have the resources and how quickly can you achieve it? So for us, I think the two big headliners going into fiscal 2019 are in the areas of transportation and overall building facility renovations. What I'm trying to do, and have said this to the committee for a couple of years, is that if we were fortunate enough to be invited into the School Building Authority's pipeline, or if we weren't, at some point we're going to have to do something to expand the building. We don't need a new school. Our school is in pretty good shape. I'm pretty darn good shape.
Great staff over there.
Great staff. Yep. We have a 1962 building with a 1992 addition, but we have 650 students. When that addition was put on in 1992-93, the overall school enrollment was under 500. So in essentially the same footprint, we continue to do a fantastic job as we're meeting the demands of the community. So my message to the committee, and the committee I think is taking the same approach, is we know we need to modernize. We need to give more space for the existing students we have. So the reason I bring that up is because part of the budget will include money set aside for stabilization that we could eventually put toward an expansion. Either we're going to eventually be invited into School Building Authority or we're not. And if we're not, what I want to avoid is a one-year spike of assessments. But if I have a sum of money that we can put toward a feasibility study, perhaps, and not have to assess the communities in any one year, like to level that out. It's very difficult to ask a community to fund your annual budget increase because those children need what they need that year.
Right.
Just so happens that's the year we might want to put on an addition. If we're saving wisely, we should be able to do both. So it's that and transportation. As a regional school, we do not receive 100% funding from the state for regional transportation. This is something that we always ask our legislative delegation to take a closer look at. We know it's difficult, but when regional transportation reimbursement goes up, all of the communities in a region benefit. That's Whitman-Hanson, and that's the South Shore Regional School District. Any regional school district benefits. And so we need to look, the legislature needs to continue to look at regional transportation because it will support our bottom line. We need to increase our bus routes. We're going to have to update our bus fleet. So that's the other big ticket item that I'm looking at.
Is there a hope? And we just got a couple of moments left here talking a little bit about South Shore Votech, located in Hanover, serving eight communities. Let me see: Scituate, Hanover, Norwell, Whitman, Hanson. Those are the easy ones. Rockland,
Abington,
and
Cohasset.
There we go.
You didn't go in alphabetical order. You threw me off there, Kevin.
I was just plucking them off the top of my head here.
That's all right.
I know that there's some great programs, automotive, electrical, you go woodworking. Are you hoping, you've got the culinary program, which does a great job. You have folks who are, when it comes to hair and nails,
cosmetology. We just opened a horticulture and landscape construction program.
Right.
A lengthy process, just introducing ninth graders to that program right now. We've put in a lot of energy there. We've reorganized a manufacturing engineering technology program. I was just at an event at Simmons Industries in Braintree earlier this afternoon. The South Shore Workforce Development Board rolled out a report saying that manufacturing is alive and well on the South Shore. And I want our graduates to take advantage and get into that industry. It's well paying. It's the second highest paid industry in our region. And my job to bring to the school board is to make sure that we have cutting edge programs that are responsive to labor market.
Right. So those students can go right into the workforce if they so choose.
Exactly right.
And our students are Massachusetts workers. They're not overseas workers, and they're U.S. workers. Mm-hmm. And that makes a big difference.
The jobs stay here.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for coming in. I hope you were satisfied with our segment that flew by.
Kevin, thanks for having us. This has been great.
If folks wanted to find out more about anything that we've talked about, is there a way for them to find out more or to be able to contact the folks over at the Votech?
Sure thing. Our website is ssvotech.org, ssvotech.org, and our main number is 781-878-8822.
All right. Well, both of you, I hope you had great holidays.
We did.
Hope you have a happy holiday, whether it's a Christmas, yes. Hanukkah, or whatever, Festivus, the rest of us.
Same to you, Kevin.
You enjoy it?
And give the best Ed Perry for us for that, too.
You probably missed him. He was in the building.
Yeah, we saw him on the way up.
I will say that Bob is an admitted listener to WATD, and we thank both of you for coming in this evening. And we'll look forward to having maybe another conversation down the road.
Looking forward to it.
All right. We are going to step aside for a moment. When we come back, Aaron Mayer Elves, author of The Crazy Bee, is on deck right here on Monday Night Talk, heard only on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk, WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to the final segment of Monday Night Talk. And as folks know, from time to time, I think it's becoming more of a regular basis, I like finding the author, the individual who has put their heart and soul into writing. It could be, I mean, we've had a number of folks, local folks here, whether it's Maureen Boyle, who was in through here a few weeks ago with her book about the New Bedford Highway, the serial killer. Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge, they have been regulars on here with, whether it was the Boston Strong book or the new book on Pete Frates. And just last week, we had this gentleman named Archer Mayer. You remember. A gentleman who, through his real life, the jobs that he does, decided to write about a detective series. And it's become quite the successful detective series. Well, we hope that the next author that you hear from, which will be in just a moment, is somebody that you'll want to check out their works of art and get to know them a little bit better through this this interview. And joining us right now on the phone line is, now, Aaron, you'll correct me if I say it wrong, or maybe your pops might, Aaron Mayer Elves. Is that correct?
Very good.
Okay. and she's here to talk to us a little bit about a book that she has written, her first book, and the book is called The Crazy Bee. And we're going to get a whole rundown on the book and some of the behind-the-scenes things, and maybe even find out if she's working on something else as well. So welcome to Monday Night Talk. Thank you for joining us this evening. And I guess the first thing is by nature, are you somebody who, are you a literary person? Are you somebody who has always aspired to write a book?
I grew up in a time where girls weren't actually told that it was okay to be nerdy. And because I grew up in the 80s, and so for me, I started to escape in books at such a young age because I would get bored with what was going on in my life, and so I would start reading and reading, and then by the time I was in sixth grade, I was pulled aside by an elementary school teacher, and direct quote, "You are a terrible child, but you can write really well." And it was like the first time that somebody had taken me aside and said, "Wow, you do something very well." In my life,
but put it in, put that whole thing, if you could kind of repeat that. They basically said something negative and then paid you a compliment.
Well, because it was when you were behavioral in the 80s, you didn't get cute little words of like, this is why they're behavioral. I was just behavioral because I was bad. Nobody talked to me what was going on with me. Instead, they just used negative terminology.
Yeah, now, if you don't mind me asking, so you did you graduate in the 80s or did you graduate in the 90s?
I graduated in 95, and at that point, I was hearing from I was a graphic design student at Southeastern, and I was still hearing from teachers. I was very talented, but I was still slightly bad, so.
So what do you like to craft? Are you somebody who that's your regular line of work? Were you doing graphic arts and you're creating artistry for other folks on a commercial level?
My favorite type of graphic design is when I'm working with a client and we come up something together so they feel like they're part of it. I've done wedding invitations and I've done shower invitations, and I spent a lot of time in art college, and I used to be a arts and crafts teacher for a long time.
Okay, so give me the concept. What was the epiphany that one day you said, you know, I want to write a book, but you also had the concept as to what the book would be about?
Anger. I got angry in the 90s because I was in the whole behavior stuff. I ended up in a psych hospital by the time I was 15 years old. I got sectioned because I did something that was dangerous to myself. And the next thing you know, my whole life changed, and I'm in a psych hospital. And I realized that I lost all my rights. And you have no rights when you're 15, but I lost all my rights. And it turned into a six-week-long adventure, and when I got out of the psych hospital, I went back to high school, and I pretended nothing happened. I didn't talk to anybody about what was going on. I had to write a story about being oppressed by the government. It was because we were studying science fiction propaganda literature, so we had to write a story about being oppressed, and I wrote a story about being in a psych hospital and accepting oppression.
Wow.
And my teacher pulled me aside and goes, "That was a beautiful story, but is it true?" And I explained it was. And so she took interest in me and kept on having me read books and books and books, and then had me write about the book so I could really learn how to actually have a style.
And what was the book? What were the series? I'm sure that there's a top three of those books that she had you read that you feel that you've magnificently captured a style or a specific style that was comfortable for you.
It's kind of a little weird because it was Dean Koontz, and he's such a dark writer who creates these worlds of, like, kind of unimaginable pain. So, and she just kept on, like, I can't even remember all the titles because she just kept on feeding them to me, and I was so, like, thirsty to figure out how to write. So we just went through it for a year. And it's not like she told anybody she was doing this or anything. She just did it, you know, because she took interest in me.
Can I tell you something that you have in common with Dean Koontz at the moment?
What?
That both of you have actually appeared on this radio show within the past 6 months.
That's weird.
Yeah, yeah. He's actually promoting a new book. And if you look in the podcast, I think I have every podcast that I've done, oh, God, dating back for the past 7 years. Probably I get over 900 podcasts. And we changed the format as to how we do the podcasts. Instead of doing like individual podcasts, now it's more or less it's the whole entire show, and I want to say it was within the past 6 months we had him on, and he was talking about this new book that he had. Now I don't have the information in front of me, but it's just ironic you bring up Dean Koontz, and he like you have appeared on this program and talked about, you know, how you the process, so to speak.
Very cool.
So kind of give us now, walk us through. You know, where did you start, and when it came to saying, "Okay, I'm gonna write a book," and who was the person you had to have a go to, or a couple of, was it this teacher, or were there other people that you would bounce your ideas off of when you were kind of going along the process?
I started writing in 2009 because I realized my life was going to change in a way that only a mentally ill person is comfortable to have this type of change. So I started writing because I knew it was the only way I was going to have a document of my recovery from mental illness. So I wasn't doing well. I wasn't healthy in about 2010. And I bump into, she's a woman now, but when I helped raise her, she was a kid I used to babysit. I started babysitting her when I was, I think, like 13, and she was 2, and at this point now she's maybe in her 20s, and she's an English teacher at a middle school, and she can tell I'm not doing well, and she's like, "What's going on there?" And I go, "I'm trying to write a book, but I don't have anybody to write to," and she goes, "You can start writing to me," And I was like, you really would, you wouldn't mind that? And she goes, no. And I warned her immediately. I go, the story's very hard to read. It's a dark story. I don't know if you're like, you know, you want to actually go through that. And she said, oh, I can read it. It's just literature. So I start sending her pages. And it was the weirdest thing. I just kept sending her pages and pages. And years are going by, and I just keep sending her stuff. And she's editing it, and she's changing it, and she's questioning, is this exactly what you want to say to the reader? And I'm starting to use tons of different literary styles to get my story across, because it's sad material, but I want it to be a fun book.
How do you put those two contexts in the same sentence? It's almost like, it's like me. I like, if I eat something, if I eat something sweet, I can have something salty. Is that what you're the concept of, where it, while it may be dark, you want it to be fun?
Well, life is kind of bittersweet. We always have bittersweet moments where you have the best visit with a loved one, but they have to leave. So my story material is sad. I went through a lot of stuff that it was painful. But in the end of the day, I've always chosen to live to live. So I wanted to make sure that the person who's reading the story gets the lesson and the moral of it, but they also kind of enjoy the ride.
So is it almost like an autobiography? Is it almost a, does it parallel your life, but you make incremental changes, so it could be its own? Kind of give us an idea here.
The publishing company that... Now it's trendy. When I first started writing this in 2000, like when I first started going through what I was going through, and I was talking about writing the book in 2011, but I was going through, I just was fed so much discrimination. So I had to power through with what I was going through and smile and do all that. But at the same time, now it's trendy. Mental health is finally being spoken about. And so I actually got my story out during Recovery Month and Suicide Prevention Month. So my publishing company was pushing me to get the book out now, because it's so relative to what's going on in society. And they also pushed me to write it as a memoir. And there's a lot of, like, because it's about mental health, there's a lot of playing back and forth with the reality. Am I a real person? Am I not a real person? Is what I'm going through real or not? Because I kind of wanted to make the reader try to figure out if it was real or not.
So not only has this been a passion, but it sounds to me like it was medicinal in some form, too?
Very cathartic. I'm very happy I chose to take bad stuff in my life and turn it into art. I'm very happy with that.
Okay. I don't want to give away the ending. And again, just so folks know, we are speaking with a local author, Erin Maha Elves, and we're talking about her book, The Crazy Bee, and we're kind of going through the steps as to how she decided to write a book and how she got to this point. Now, while you and I were kind of doing kind of the warm-up in the bullpen, to get to know each other a little bit and know where the conversation would go, one of the things that you had shared with me is that this there's a controversy to this. Have we told the controversy? Have you shared that? Or is there more to any controversy that is surrounded with the book itself?
The actual controversy is, because I was 15 and angry at the mental health system, I was so upset that I had no role models. You have to understand, when you get out of a psych hospital, you can't eat, like back then, because it was the 90s. I couldn't speak about what I had gone through, and I had no role models to sustain normalcy, because my goal when I was growing up was to always sustain a normal life, even though I have mental health issues. So what I ended up doing was kind of a little controversial. I went from having like a psychotic break at 15, 16, to going back to work and choosing my profession to work with children. So I ended up being a teacher for over 20 years. And then when I was outed in court in 2011, that's where the controversy started, because I called my local newspapers to explain, oh, mentally ill mothers can lose custody of their kids if they go into psych hospitals, if they get treatment. And I kept on hearing over and over again, not just from newspapers, from friends and like from people who had known me my whole life, they kept saying, you shouldn't have worked with children, never mind having children, because you're mentally ill, and mentally ill people shouldn't have those things. And I remember smiling with just a crazy smile and going, that's your ignorance and you don't understand and that's okay. So I had to keep on smiling through people saying things to me that were insensitive and rude and discriminatory. And I thankfully handled it well because I have a high tolerance to ignorance.
And so you were able to persevere, and is this stuff that's also in the book as well, as talking about the ignorance and talking about how all these, whether it's, you know, folks in the media or just people in general, saying, hey, as someone who is mental, that has mental health issues, you should not, you have no rights. You shouldn't be able to bear children. You shouldn't even walk across the street. I mean, is that in the book?
Yeah, you actually, you feel like it happens to you because I write in this way where I speak directly to the reader because the story is about surviving suicide attempt and moving on in your life and figuring out why you're alive. And because it was the only way that I could communicate to anybody that you have no clue what's going to happen next. And so if you take away your life, you're like, you're shutting it down. You have no chance to have anything change. And so I survived, and everything just kept on slowly, slowly changing. And I document the years that it's passing, that years are going by, and everything is changing in my life, and for the better. And I'm getting healthier and healthier to the point where I'm at now.
Well, you mentioned a couple of things during our conversation here. You talk about, you know, there was a time in the 80s where, you know, it was almost like illegal to be a nerd, or, you know, talking about, you know, having mental health issues and how people, the perception. Do you feel that perceptions have changed in areas like that, or do you feel that they're still evolving and they need to continue evolving?
We're at a point in society that we have to have a change of how we see mental health, because we need to have a conversation, especially with our children, especially with our teenage children, that like we know you're going through something, that you're going through something that is hard, and the discrimination, the stigma will eventually stop, and it will be a trend eventually that we're going to have healthy conversations about mental health. But what's going on right now is we're about to have a mental health crisis. By 2020, all Americans are supposedly going to have mental illness. The government figured it out in 2010, and they put out a cute little website called Healthy People 2020, which is awesome, but it's not talking about why it's okay to have mental health issues. In other countries right now, they're aware that we're having a mental health crisis in 2020, and they're already starting the conversation in a positive manner. Mental health has always been such a stigmatized, taboo subject that we just can't talk about it. We are conditioned not to speak about it. My book can't change it. My book can't, like, it can't fix it. There's no, like, actual fix to this. But people like me trying to talk about it like it's a normal subject is starting the conversation.
So it sounds to me as though with the title of the book, now, were you able to choose the title of the book, or was that through the publisher?
I got to choose the title. The actual story behind it is I'm a crazy, you know, inappropriate word. Because when I was going through my divorce proceedings with my ex-husband, I walked over to him, and it was 2009, and I look at him, and I go, okay, I understand that you can take me to court and get the kids away from me, because I'm not even supposed to have children, ha-ha. And I looked at him and I said, are you going to take me to court? And he goes, oh, I would never take you to court. I'm like, yeah, okay, I believe you. And then that was the year I started writing the book, because I knew that I was going to have to go to court because I was going to get treatment for my mental health and he was going to use it against me. So I kind of, it's almost like a joke, like, you know, don't push a really nice person to get so angry that they have to document their recovery in a book. Because I have two daughters now, and it's cute now if my kids say, oh, my mom wrote the crazy B, but it would have never been appropriate for them to say the negative word.
What was it like to finally see the finished product? I mean, what was it like to get it over the finish line where you got it all together, front to back, and then, you know, they put together the concept art to have the book completed and show you?
The company I went with, we went step by step together, which was awesome because I have the background in graphic design, so I really got to put my input in. But by the time that I got it home, like, and it was in the mail, and I'm sitting outside and I'm doing a video, and I share it with my Facebook friends because they've been following me for years writing this book. It was like a complete dream come true, because to think in your head when you're a 15-year-old kid, I want to write this story and it's going to help the next generation, it's going to help everybody, to actually have it in your hand and just be able to be proud of yourself because it was something I worked for.
If I could transport you back to being that 15-year-old kid that was on the cusp of taking, from what I'm understanding here, you're on the cusp of taking your own life, is that correct?
Yes, I would go back and forth with being suicidal when I was growing up.
But isn't that, I mean, aren't we seeing these days when it comes to the teen suicide rate that it's pretty high, and it's something that is, it's not just something that Aaron is afflicted with, but that our teens are afflicted with?
The rate of the suicide right now is that 90% of people with known mental illnesses are committing suicide. And it's affecting the younger generation because they weren't taught to how to communicate their feelings. I grew up silently suffering without speaking to my mother or my father because I didn't know how to be like, well, this is how I cope. I don't know how you guys cope, but I'm coping by being suicidal. It's teaching children to actually communicate with their parents the truth, the honest truth that, you know, I'm not perfect, I'm suffering, and I need help.
What was it like when, as far as getting the first books out there, what have you heard from folks who have sat down, who have read it, whether it's constructive criticism or accolades?
The hardest part was somebody who was young read my book, and she got herself into a situation where she had to be admitted into a psych hospital because after she read my book, she realized how suicidal she was, and she didn't want to live like that anymore. So she was admitted into a psych hospital, and now it's a year later, and she's in college. She has a full-time job, and she's engaged to be married and moving out with her boyfriend very soon and healthy. But that was one of the hardest things to deal with because I didn't think that could happen.
Okay. Any thoughts as to where do you go from here other than promoting this book? Do you get any fresh ideas for maybe another book? Because myself, I find it an interesting concept when someone is able to write a book and then before you know it, it's almost like the bug hits you. Hey, wow. You know, that was a journey to be able to, from start to finish, and then be able to put it out there and have other people read it and give me their feedback, it's almost like a drug.
Well, my next book is called Resilient, and it's going to be a story of not only my stories of strength, but friends and family stories of strength, where you learn how to push through the pain no matter how hard it is.
Now, is this strictly just from folks that you know who are going through tough times, but yet have shown that resilience, and mm-hmm. and any thought of maybe getting a clinician in to somehow be a part of it, or is it strictly just stories of folks who have persevered?
My writing style is so anti-clinician because I hate the way the mental health field is treated in America. Because at this point, my therapist took away all my diagnoses after he read the book. He literally read the book, and he took it as a nice, kind way of me saying the mental health system can now just go to heck, and I don't want to deal with you guys ever again.
Right.
And so he was so happy to finish the book, and he was just like, okay, you don't have to come to therapy anymore. You're all set. Good. You know, it was really nice treating you. And then he started getting sad and goes, can we still see each other? And I said, sure. And he goes, for book two? And I said, sure. So I'm going to continue to stay in therapy, but my point of view will never be the clinical point of view because I'm just a mere person who went through a very hard system that is trying to give guidance to the next generation or even my generation how to survive it.
Where do you feel that mental health, as far as treatment goes, where do you feel that it's going wrong? Do you feel that, you know, from back when you were 15 years old to, you know, seeing somebody who you've had conversations with, where is it going wrong, and where do you feel that it needs to get back on track?
The first thing, when you're being told that you have mental health issues, you have to be told at the same exact moment you are a human being. There, you have value, you have substance, you have creativeness, you have spirituality, you are more than your mental illness. What's going wrong is that we keep talking about what is wrong with somebody and not what is right. My mantra since I was 15 years old was pretty much, screw them, you are more than your mental illness, no matter what I went through. And I'm an overachiever, like I excel all the time, and it's never good enough, but I always will just continue to excel. And I graduated from Mass Associated Dean's List student, and I was a student senator, and I volunteered at the Special Olympics. There was so much more to me than just my mental illness. It was just that in my head, because I had gotten sick thinking, I kept being repetitive with my negative thoughts, and I couldn't speak about that I had negative thoughts because it's not acceptable. We need to make sure that whoever has mental health issues understands that their value is so much more than that.
Any fear, you know, these days, the one thing that is synonymous with mental health and mental health issues, and I hear it repeatedly, is when there's gun violence. What goes through your head when those two are in the same sentence?
A little too late. I always keep, because I track everything, because I want to make sure that I understand what's going on. And so I go, okay, we have another person who obviously is sick, who's obviously not stable. Mm-hmm. There's evil in the world. There's always going to be evil in the world. But when somebody gets to the point that they're about to hurt somebody, they need to be actually capable of saying, I'm sick and I need help. I had a friend recently whose friend had a psychotic break, and he started saying the voices are telling me to hurt others, and thankfully the kid communicated, I'm having trouble, I need help. And he ended up in a hospital for a few weeks, got stabilized, and then was released back to society and is functioning enough that he's not hurting others. We have to make sure that people understand that these thoughts are not normal thoughts. It's not okay to hurt everybody. It's not okay to take your pain out on somebody else. And we also need to teach how to cope with bad things, because we always hear that this one person was triggered, and the next thing you know, they were pushed to hurt other people. The amount of crap that I've gone through in my life, I've always used my spirituality to connect to the fact that people are doing things wrong to me, but it's not because they want to, it's because of their ignorance. Again, we're not even talking about hurting ourselves or hurting others because it's such a taboo subject. Well, it's coming out of being taboo, but we have to have a conversation about it.
We've been speaking with Erin Maha Elves and talking about her new book, The Crazy Bee, and we've plumb out of time, and I want to say it's been a great conversation. I want to thank you for sharing your story, talking about your book. If folks are interested in purchasing your book or getting your book, how can they do that?
It's on Amazon. It's called The Crazy Bee.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you'll stay in touch and let us know how your next project is going, and share details of that with our audience here on Monday Night Talk.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You got it. Well, that's all the time that we have here, folks. You have been listening to Monday Night Talk, and we want to thank all of our guests. And until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great evening.